Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion.
Daryl Jones, welcome to the inaugural episode of Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to be here.
It's so exciting to be together. And you and I met in one of my favorite places, Chicago. And we were part of a spiritual community there. So we share that. And I was thinking today about you being one of my spiritual teachers and how that's been such a great blessing in my life. So thank you.
Thank you.
And and I love that you are the general manager of Chill. Mm-hmm. So could you, so for our audience and for me, could you just tell me the short Daryl Jones story and background and how you became, what is Chill and how you became the general manager of Chill?
Sure, absolutely. So my personal professional background is as a minister. So I don't usually use it a whole heck of a lot, but I am a Reverend Daryl Jones. And I've always been interested in helping people further their heart when it comes to connection to whatever they may see as a greater presence, a higher power, God, universe. And one of the professional challenges that I have found, to be quite honest with that profession, is the sustainability when it comes to making a living. And so I've attempted a number of different times on my own to branch out and find and explore ways to sustain an income, and still continue to do so. And I recognize that there's a very similar conversation that takes place in the secular world outside of the specific spiritual context that is based on the same principles that I love to champion in the spiritual work. And so about 3.5, almost 4 years ago now, I was looking for work. And what I told myself was I have to do something connected to meditation because that is the thing for me that is the basis of all growth, awareness, and opportunity. And so I literally went on Craigslist and typed in, the only search criteria was meditation. And one job came up and it was this new business called Chill Meditation and Massage looking for meditation instructors. And the way that it was described as someone who embraces all these practices but isn't too woo-woo, grounded in science. And my wife was like, it sounds like you. So I applied, and within, I think, just a matter of days, I was having a face-to-face sit down with the owner. And that quickly turned into, I need someone to help manage our team. It was an entrepreneurial startup, so quickly things are constantly shifting in terms of personnel and staff. And I was someone who was integral in the first few months of things getting going. And there needed to be some other management to other components of the business. And she just said, hey, how would you like to be general manager? So I've done that on and off for 3 years now. And we're currently pivoting with the current state of our physical distancing to an app. Called Chill Anywhere. So we still are located in Chicago. It was a physical studio downtown, but now we have an app that we are launching, that we have launched. We're having a big launch party starting July 13th, and it's literally chilling anywhere, any time of day with guided meditations. And so I help manage the teachers, what the practices are, and bringing forward the content of Chill. And this word Chill, it was this colloquial, you know, term intentionally, as opposed to saying something specifically about mindfulness or specifically about meditation. I think regardless of anyone's belief, everyone gets the notion of you know, you need to chill out, take a chill pill, relax. So that's how the in a nutshell, the business came forward in my relationship to it in particular.
I love the name Chill. I think it's amazing. It's like my favorite brand ever. So before we got on and started recording, I had the pleasure of leading us both in a little meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could bring mindfulness to our podcast and our chat. And I feel like what came up for you is so fascinating. So why don't you tell us about togethering?
Sure. It's that particular word, like I said, I think it might be made up. I don't know. Togethering is something that people actually use or say.
Well, they will now, Daryl. We have to trademark it for you.
but it was in response to a lot of the social justice conversations that are taking place now, that have been taking place for decades and centuries, but in particular, this word of othering and highlighting how people are othered or excluded or marginalized is an important thing to do. But from the standpoint of spiritual principle, for me, whatever we give our attention to is what we propagate. Whatever we give our awareness to is what is fueled. So even if we bring our attention to othering with the energy of love to like free people from that, by giving it some of that kind of angsty othering, wrong, shut down, someone's good, someone's bad, it really just promotes othering. And so the download in your brief and awesome meditation was this togethering. What can we do and what does that look like to promote togethering and let that be the intention, the purpose, the mission, if you will, as it relates to compassionate leadership. But I think our life in general right now, we're standing at a very critical point in our current and contemporary history. And we have the opportunity to really shift gears in a powerful way. But I think it starts with an internal practice, awareness, and moves outward, as opposed to just continuing to moving pieces of the puzzle around or moving pieces around on the chessboard. Because that's just moving things. It's not really going back to the puzzler or the game player. Where the decisions are made, where the consciousness, the eyes that look out into the world, how are they looking? So if we can look out into the world from a space of togethering, with the intention of togethering, how might that influence conversations that we have about healthcare? How might that influence conversations that we have about identity in this country, whether it be race, gender, sexual orientation? It's a very different tone for me. I hope that the listeners can kind of maybe feel a little bit of that to point out, well, they're othering. I'm going to find out how they're othering and where they're othering and how I'm being othered. And even when I say that, I'm kind of like squinching my face a little bit. But to say, how are we togethering? How can I promote togethering? How are they possibly supporting togethering? And how can I invite togethering? Is a very different intent to any conversation. And so that's what came forward as we prepared for today's call.
I think it's fantastic. And I feel like I'm learning something already from the concept. Let's shift a little bit, because we're in these times and you and I got to talk about what's going on with you and your family and your life. I'd like to talk a little bit about the fact that you've lost your dad at the beginning of the pandemic.
Sure.
And how was that for you and your family? Because I think that's just important to bring your dad into the space as well.
Yeah. Well, without a doubt, my father I don't know if he ever used the word together, but he was all about that. My father too was a minister for almost five decades, and end of 2018 he was diagnosed with mesothelioma, a very aggressive, angry cancer that really doesn't have the ability to be cured or cut out, just kind of quelled. And so he tried to quell it as best as he could for about 16 months. And after the turn of this new year, the treatments that he was on just really weren't doing anything to pause it anymore. Maybe did one more round. And in February, I got a call from my mother and a hospice nurse saying, you know, you probably want to come home sooner than later. So literally that day I got on a plane and went home. And by March 2nd, my father passed away. And that was right before a lot of the more national, like, you know, statewide shelter in place requests or requirements were there. So I'm grateful that, you know, in terms of when he passed, that it happened prior to that, because we were able to have over 600 people, 700 people at his funeral to celebrate his life. It had just been a few weeks later, probably that wouldn't have happened. And just in terms of the process, I mean, the gift for me, and I don't know if my mother would call it a gift right now or not, but the gift of the shelter in place was that it kind of sheltered me into being with my grief, being with my sadness, in a way that I probably wouldn't have if I was getting up and going to work and moving through the world in a normal way, or how, whatever normal is, however I was going through, having a commute and interacting with people. So it's been very, very powerful. I'm still lossing or grieving or losing. Just this morning, there's pictures down the hallway of my home. And there's such a part of me that misses the guidance and the direction and just the tone of how my father approached life that normally I'd be leaning into in a situation like this. So it's training me, I guess. It's extending my personal practice of, you know, as a minister and as a spiritual practitioner and understanding my beliefs of what is it that I'm connecting to. Is it about always connecting to something tangible? You know, tangibly, my father represented an idea of spirituality for me. Now his tangible physical existence is not here. So can I still lean into something? And I know the answer is yes. I've been doing it for decades, but this is obviously very personal. And the grief and the loss in and of itself is enough, but then to throw in the stress of a pandemic, to throw in the stress of the state of our country as it relates to racial relations and history, and how we're going to move forward. It's a lot. And I don't even know if grateful does it justice. I honestly don't know where I would be right now if it wasn't for my personal practice of prayer and meditation, contemplation, reading. Just this morning, I was listening a little bit to Howard Thurman, if you're familiar with him. And so I just keep returning to the things that have supported and buoyed me for the past 20 years or so, as I really deepen my spiritual journey. And principle is principle, right? So regardless of how big or small the challenge may be in life, right now everything feels very big and amplified, but the truth is where I put my attention and how I bring my attitude forward influences the experience of the moment. So I continue to return to that remembering and pause as much as I can to check in with how am I breathing even, you know, how am I seeing, how am I listening? Is it through the filter of othering or togethering? Is it through the filter of hate and anger or love and compassion? And it's not constant, it's constantly moving. There's moments I check in and I can feel hate, I can feel anger, I can feel frustration. And then the question is, do I want to stay here? And is this how I want my experience of life to be? Is this the way that I want to lead and show an example and be of service to the world? And the answer is no, I don't want to be of service to hate. I don't want to be of service to othering. I don't want to be of service to frustration. Is it okay to be frustrated? Is it okay to be angry? Is it okay to experience hate? Absolutely. And that is not the underlying tone or bed of soil that I want to grow my life from. So I do my work to pull the weeds or to do the pruning, whatever analogy works, to continue to create a consciousness, a heart, a body, and a mind that is fertile and a place to bring forward love, compassion, kindness, acceptance, opportunity, and expansion for myself and for everyone that I connect with.
It's a good time to be in the love and compassion business, I think.
I do agree.
And I'm so sorry about your father. I lost my mother 3 years ago. I'm so happy that your family got to say goodbye and the community got to say goodbye together. I think often about people that are losing people now. I don't know how you grieve without saying goodbye, or, you know, it's just really, my heart goes out to them and my prayers go out to them. And
closure is so important. And I think a lot of people aren't. I had a cousin, her 35-year-old son passed away, just didn't wake up. And I don't know if they actually completed an autopsy, because this was much earlier in the shelter in place in terms of where resources were being allocated in the healthcare system at the time. I don't know if she actually, I mean, they had some sort of service, but there's a level of closure that's just not there. And my heart goes out to her, and I'm sure that's just one slice of many, many, many.
I'm sorry for your family's loss there as well. Currently I'm very blessed with my family being, you know, healthy, and there's just so much to know or not to know or to learn from. So I appreciate that, you know, meditation, prayer, God, this is the family business. And curious, like, what does your practice look like? Do you have like a number of hours you put in a day, or how does it go for you, like, sure, right now?
A principle that I personally really champion in my teaching, but I do it in my personal practice as well. There's something to be said for quantity of time, but quantity does not necessarily make a good practice. I believe it's the quality of our attention. So it depends a little bit on the day. My goal and intent is to have a mindful moment and a mindful pause at a minimum of twice a day. Usually I like to bookend it. You know, I want to start my day with some sort of intention, and I want to close my day with some sort of reflection. Again, depending upon the day and what's being engaged and what sort of meetings I have and what sort of teaching I'm doing, the teacher training that I offer with a colleague of mine through CHILL, one of the things we always say to the students is that don't let your teaching be your practice, because you're not present in the same way, because you're kind of there as a lifeguard. You know, you're scanning and looking and checking in, and you're facilitating something. So I am really mindful of that, of trying to find moments just for me and my personal practice. Sometimes it looks like 5 minutes. Sometimes it looks like, you know, an hour a day. It's a matter of scheduling what time I went to bed the night before, you know. But there's always some moments of pause. And sometimes the 5 minute practice can be just as, if not more powerful than one that is 30 minutes, because my intent and the quality of my attention sometimes is so focused, it's so present, it's so aware, as opposed to 30 minutes where maybe I may wander off and fall asleep and get drowsy, and that's just part of the meditation process. But at a minimum, I try to pause twice a day in some sort of formal way. That can look like sitting in a chair, sitting on the ground. Sometimes I'm blessed with my home. I have an outdoor roof deck. So on a nice day, to go out and just, you know, enjoy the feeling of sun hitting my skin and connecting with nature, but still it being a meditative pause. There's so much. I'm inside my apartment a lot. So every opportunity I get to walk, I have been doing some walking meditations, because it's just getting me out of my home and out of the places that I'm sitting all day long. And just right now in Chicago, there's so much blooming and growing and blossoming. And my neighbors up and down all the blocks have lots of sidewalk gardens. So it's been a joy to connect with nature as a way of meditating. But sometimes the end of the day meditation is me getting in bed. And before I kind of turn into that position of sleep, I'll lay on my back, because I don't sleep well on my back. But I'll almost go into like a Shavasana pose, like you would at the end of a yoga class. And I'll just give myself 5 minutes, 10 minutes of relaxation, and then reviewing my day. And usually it's a gratitude practice. What, you know, what was I grateful for that passed through my experience today?
I like that our meditation expert is giving us lots of options, because I think sometimes people think meditation looks a certain way. When I work with people, I say, okay, if you don't know how to meditate, close your eyes and breathe 3 times and you're meditating, right? And I think one of the best definitions I ever heard is, you know, meditation is listening to God and prayer is speaking to God. Or if you don't like the word God, you can use world, universe, love.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening is such an important practice. That's why I think meditation makes everyone a better communicator, because most of us don't listen very well. We like to talk.
Well, which kind of brings me back to othering and togethering. I'm really loving this. I think you should write a book about it. So one of my intentions today was in this social justice, I don't know what to call it, swirl, progress, whatever it is. I've been trying to listen and trying to understand, and I am, you know, a white woman now living in Sag Harbor, New York. And today I'm talking to a black man that is in the middle of Chicago. And I would just love to hear what it's been like for you to see this shift in history.
It's interesting. I was just pausing on the idea of shift in history. I don't know if it's a shift yet.
Mm. So maybe it's a shift for me, and maybe it's just, you know, whatever it is for you. Tell me about it, because I want to learn.
Yeah, well, I just in terms of, you know, togethering and othering, one of the most profound experiences that I went through once at a convention, and it was on diversity and inclusion, And this is, I think, not an original exercise, but it highlights so poignantly what happens when we other people, is that we distill them down to usually one or two attributes or qualities. And that's it, right? So if you could think of five things that you celebrate about yourself quickly, you know, your name, your hair, and then all of a sudden I say, okay, you've got to let one of those go. And now you're only going to be known by four things. And then you let another one go and you go all the way down to one. And in leading an exercise like that, people literally start to squirm. So like, how do I pick? How do I let go of that? And when we other people, we're usually not taking in the wholeness or the totality of an individual. We're making them a single note. And the reason I bring that up is as I sit here, it's much more than me being a black man. It's me being a 47-year-old in terms of the history of the world and what I grew up with. It's me growing up not only as a black man, because that's how people see me and that's how I identify, but also growing up in a mixed-race home with a mother who is of European descent. You know, someone who grew up in the Midwest, who was born on the East Coast and moved because of the neighborhoods that were there were fairly segregated into a conservative state of Ohio, but in a little microcosm of inclusivity. All of that plays out. So I grew up with inclusion and togethering as the norm. And so the experience that I'm having in terms of my experience as a black man is better understanding the historical reference to the experience of someone like my father, or even, you know, ancestors older than him, of the othering that they did experience, the true being simplified down to the color of your skin, and that being the only thing that is identified as you. That's the only way that you are understood and related to in the world. And so as I witness conversations, both on the full spectrum, so this to me is less about someone having a right way and a wrong way. I'm watching the way everyone is interacting. And it's just like, wow. I mean, everyone's in so much pain. Everyone's so angry. And in terms of the shift, to your point, Laurel, I think there's a lot of waking up and understanding, whether it's me in terms of my age and the privilege that I had not being a black man like in the 30s or in the 40s or in the 50s, me understanding, you know, it being more than just something I read in a book or a story that my father told me. It's like, oh, wow, I can totally see an experience. And there's some connection now between my personal experience and that history and what I see going forward. And then I think a lot of the pain that is being experienced right now is even more so by non-blacks in the country, of really understanding the impact of our history. And then maybe the impact of either indecision or thinking, I'm not directly making anything happen. I'm not shooting anyone. I'm not calling anyone nigger. I'm not hitting anyone in the face. I'm not purposely excluding anyone. But this implicit kind of like subversive othering that happens unconsciously by many people. I think a lot of us are waking up to that, and that's scary. And so that's what I see. I mean, here in Chicago, in this urban center, the protests are just, they're nonstop. They're continuing. And people want to be heard. And I celebrate that, you know, wanting to be heard. And I'm still trying to figure out the best way to invite conversation. But I really want to be a champion for the coming together of everyone, especially those who may be considered a little bit more extreme, not to try to influence anyone, not to try to change anyone necessarily, but to promote living together. Because I don't really know what people think is going to happen, that, you know, I'll get into my conspiracy theory for a minute. You know, like, people are talking about vaccines with COVID, and, you know, are they going to put something in the vaccine that's going to make everyone numb to the differences that exist, and all of a sudden, you know, we're just going to be okay? Like, no, there's going to be differences always. And there isn't a normal. And to understand that, because one person or one group's understanding of normal is not embraced in the same way or practiced in the same way or even just outpictured into the world in the same way, is not grounds to push them outside of society and to say, well, if you're not doing this the way that we want to, if you're not looking or speaking or acting or voting or whatever, the same way that this kind of mainstream or more prevalent group is, then something is wrong with you and you need to do something to come over here or get closer. That's what I'm always thinking about. I mean, bring it back to othering and togethering, there's always othering happening. And I that is where my greatest concern is, as a person who falls into marginalized groups, falls into other groups. I've had enough of that.
So when earlier you said this is scary, so what most scares you and what gives you the most hope?
Sure. I think what most scares me is the way anger is, I don't want to say it's not being embraced because it's being expressed, but I feel like sometimes it is being misdirected. And I'm scared by the thought that in order for anger to be resolved, that someone has to almost be punished. And that punishment doesn't do anything to really, I think, resolve anger. I think forgiveness, I think understanding, I think compassion is what promotes togethering. Because when we punish someone, all we're doing is othering them and putting them away. You know, I don't want to get into the whole thing of our correctional system, but I just don't understand how is someone going to be rehabilitated from isolation? I mean, we've all experienced it in a very powerful way for the past almost 4 months now. And I know I don't feel any healthier as a person. I know that the extreme behaviors maybe that are a little bit on the fringe for me personally and my personality and my ego, those have been amplified as opposed to, you know, quieted. And so that's the thing about the anger that I see right now. I don't think it's wrong, but it's very, very misguided and misplaced. And I don't think people understand how to be with anger. It's such a powerful energy. It's such a powerful emotion. And I don't think a lot of us are responsible with it. It can be used for actually so much good. And I see it being used for a lot of harm. That's not going
to... I agree with you. I think that Learning to express anger in a productive way is an opportunity for our society, as is grief. Like, I think, I appreciate that you think of this sheltering in place as an opportunity to grieve, because you know about grief and you've helped other people with grief. And I think as a society, we don't really know what to do with grief or anger, and it can be transformed. It needs to be expressed, because that's where our humanity is, right? Like, I was thinking a lot about humanity over the last few days, and I was thinking about, you know, we come together as community when babies are born and when we leave the planet, and it seems like there's this higher vibration for both of those things, and the opportunity is to figure out that vibration for other events like shifts in social justice or, you know. So what is your biggest... from this time, from this interesting 2020 time, what is your greatest hope?
I mean, it's almost the same thing. I am hopeful. I'm hopeful for the frustration and anger that people are experiencing. It gives me hope, because I think we are in the process of learning from that anger, from that frustration. One of my mentors, I can't remember if it was Mark Anthony or Reverend Michael Beckwith, but the phrase divine discontent, that to feel discontented, there's divinity in it. There's something spiritual about that. And that's, you know, again, back to that idea of embracing and togethering, not even pushing aside and othering the emotions that we don't want to experience, that we don't want to feel, that maybe don't look pretty or feel great, to welcome all of that in and recognize that that's part of the richness and the fullness of life. That is what gives me some hope, is that the people aren't just doing, you know, one protest and it's done. People are going out and saying, hey, look at me, let's talk about this. This is something that doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand why. And these conversations that I'm having with you, there's so many more of these taking place. People are hungry to understand, I think, more about themselves, but more about others that maybe they wouldn't have had dialogue with previously. So that gives me great hope. That is what is required to bring about the sustained change, I think, that everyone on some level would really like to see. It's scary for some as it relates to power. But the healthiness, the equilibrium, the balance, the evenness, the deeper and richer community that I think a lot of people would like to experience will come out of the divine discontent that is happening right now, and the conversations and the study and the reflection. You know, to think of mindfulness is the process of becoming aware. We are in a great space of becoming more aware of ourselves. And right now, unfortunately, in that awareness, it's the more painful side, because we are waking up to the ways that behaviors, patterns, societal behaviors and patterns have propagated and continued to create a world that doesn't work for everyone. And for those who do want a world that works for everyone really taking their responsibility to understand that and become more aware of it and awaken to it, ask questions and be in dialogue. That's what's happening right now. It's slow. It's not, you know, an algorithm that you can throw into an app. It shoots out a process. There's an internal kind of spiritual algorithm, I think, that's working itself right now. And if we're receptive to it, if we create space for it, I trust that it will bring about the change that we all see.
So how do we do more togethering? So I'll just talk about myself. Because when you started othering, I was like, I'm definitely doing some othering with some leaders in Washington, right? And I actually am trying to, I haven't been very successful at a consistent practice, but my podcast partner is a Buddhist, and she, you know, we reminded of, you know, putting that person or those people and understanding that we are them and there's oneness with them. I'm actually have homework to do about meditating and bringing love to them. So how do, so that's one practice we can all do is just remember that we're all human and we're all connected and we're all one. And we're you know, as we're celebrating 4th of July tomorrow, thinking about, you know, our country and, you know, loving our country and healing our country and literally healing our country because we're challenged with an illness that is hurting and killing a lot of people in our country. So, how do we bring it back to ourselves, this idea of othering and togethering?
Sure.
On a daily basis.
I think to bring forward another spiritual leader and teacher who's no longer with us, Mother Teresa, it's an oft-used example, but I think there's something really powerful. Again, it comes back to principle and what is the consciousness that we're stepping into the world. We own our consciousness and no one else does. It's influenced by the external world, but we are ultimately the ones that choose the mindset, the heart set that engages with everything. And so the example of Mother Teresa, you know, decades ago when there were protests against wars, when there were protests against this, you know, the casting system in India and all these things that were wrong or people said they were wrong, they invited her to come to these protests and she always replied no. And a lot of people didn't understand it. And she said, give me a rally that's for peace and that's what I'll show up for. And, you know, there's so many different spiritual traditions that speak to this in different ways. There's a lot of more contemporary new age teachers that speak to this. But the underlying principle for me is, what is it that we are for? If this world, like I'm looking out my window right now, and seeing the tops of trees and birds, you know, creating life and moving things around in their nests and whatnot. Like, there's this creative cycle that is constantly going on. And all it does is want to create more of itself. And if it has the right elements and properties, you know, to use the soil as a reference, it will grow whatever is implanted in that soil. Whether it is a tomato plant, whether it is an oak tree, whether it's a weed that takes everything up and takes up all the space and kills off the other plants, it doesn't matter. The ground doesn't go, oh, I don't think we want to grow any weeds over here because they're trying to grow tomato plants over there. No, it's just like, okay, the thing is here. It's being given sun. It's being given water. It's getting the nutrients that it needs. This, I'm growing this thing. So what is it that we want to grow? And what is it that we are for? The othering is about against energy. It is about negation. It is about duality of someone being right and someone being wrong. If we were to pause for a minute and hold ourselves in the same disdain that we hold some of our other leaders in because they've done or said something wrong. And if we were honest with ourselves about how many times we've done or said something wrong, then we should be scrutinizing and lambasting ourselves all over social media as well. I completely suck. I said this in 1985, you know, and I'm not trying to diminish that people don't need to be responsible for their behaviors or things that they said or their unawareness to things. But in terms of us being able to come together in this fertile time right now, which shift can can happen, what are we for, as opposed to what are we against? Because if we only identify what is it that we are against, what is it that we don't like, what is it that we consider to be bad, what is it that we consider to be wrong, then that is where our energy, that is where our consciousness, that is where our sometimes dollars end up going to. And that's fueling literally that which we don't desire. We are giving creative input to life, to the thing that we're saying we don't want. All the while, the thing over here that we may actually want to give our energy to, we're not even looking at, because we're going, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, they're wrong, they're wrong. And, you know, I won't be political, but I won't, you know, hide my disdain about how President Trump is leading. And I have my moments with myself where I'm just like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that, you know. But I don't give a whole lot of time on, you know, having conversations with people about, oh my God, can you believe he said that? Can you believe he said that? Oh my God, I can't believe, I want to tweet about it, you know? No, I want to have a conversation with you and get into this idea of what is it that, what can we do? Some people are going to make decisions that we don't like. They're going to behave in ways that just completely baffle us. And I don't have that direct path to sit down and have a conversation with him. I've been wanting to talk to him for the entirety of his presidency and still would love to. And I don't know how to make that happen. So what I can happen, what I can influence, what I can be for is celebrating together, celebrating awareness, celebrating the responsibility that I think we all need to take for our own awareness, our own biases, our own blind spots. And the way we begin by doing that is getting still and getting quiet, and reflecting and doing some personal inventory. And sometimes it's formal, sometimes it can just be a passing few moments, but that's the constant exercise and practice. I think the last time we connected, this book that I'm writing called Soul Gym, it's based around this idea of a fit soul. What does that mean? And you know, our soul is not something that gets to a certain level of understanding or living or expression. Just like the body needs to constantly be engaged if we want to keep it strong and supple, we have to exercise it pretty regularly. Our soul, our consciousness, our mind, our heart needs to constantly be exercised and stretched. And in particular, to come back to compassion as it relates to your podcast and this talk, compassion is not our default today. And even for the compassionate heart like myself, I engage with social media all the time. I read the newspaper because I want to be informed. I'm not inundating myself. But most of what I read is not compassionate. Most of what I hear is not compassionate. So it behooves me to be a place to practice compassion, so that I can bring that, that's what I'm for, is compassion. That's what I want to bring even to reading an article in the newspaper, even to a conversation with someone that doesn't have the same opinion as something as, you know, fundamental as, do I wear a mask? Don't I wear a mask when I go outside? You know, I want to bring compassion to that conversation because we're all trying to figure this out. None of us know the answer to anything.
Thank you for all of that. That was beautiful. And Mr. Trump, if you're listening, Daryl and I would like to invite you onto our podcast to talk.
Absolutely.
And I've been thinking a lot about how I need to talk to people that are different and have different ideas that I do for understanding, and have a commitment to find people who have different political views to talk to. Because there's a lot of, you know, there's humanity everywhere. And so you're adding fuel to that fire for me. As suspected, I knew this talk was going to be precious and important. And I so appreciate your time. And we'll be writing a piece about Daryl Jones and Chill and Soul Gym that you can find at Forbes.com or CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. And I hope that all of you are doing more togethering today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laurel.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders Podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.